offers to seven business before the Honorable Court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Boscarino. Mr. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors. The first issue which I will discuss is whether honest services can serve as a predicate for a money laundering offense. The parties agree that a de novo standard of review applies to this question. We would submit that this issue is one of first impression with respect to the money laundering statutes. The mail and wire fraud statutes require proof of a scheme to defraud, and there are three permissible objects of a scheme to defraud. One, of course, is money. Two, of course, is property. And three, after the enactment of 18 U.S.C. 1346, is honest services. Obviously, money can be laundered in a monetary transaction, and some types of properties can be laundered in a monetary transaction. Our position is a relatively simple one, and that is, does the deprivation of honest services object, that intangible right, is that a proceeds which can be laundered in a monetary transaction? Another way of looking at this is, does the money laundering statute require that it be the object of the scheme to defraud, that be the thing that is laundered? We would suggest that this much is clear from looking.
I'm puzzled. Was there any problem with the instruction saying that only proceeds of an offense can be laundered?
You
have an honest services fraud that does not produce any proceeds. Obviously, you don't have money laundering because you don't have any money. If you have an honest services fraud that does have proceeds that are capable of being laundered, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that the scheme to defraud must produce an object of the fraud.
That's what I'm talking about, the proceeds.
Right, the proceeds. And the object of the fraud can be money, property, or honest services. If you look at the purpose of a money laundering statute, you have to have a predicate crime which produces proceeds. And money laundering statute focuses on what happens to those proceeds. Proceeds is a very economic term. It's money-based. It's not grounded in intangible rights. And the purpose of the money laundering statute is to focus on the disposition of proceeds. Well, when one schemes to defraud an entity of honest services, the thing that is deprived are the honest services. And that's not a tangible right. It's not a monetary instrument that can be laundered in a monetary transaction.
Obviously not. But I still don't understand what the significance of that is. If you have an honest services fraud that produces financial proceeds, and the financial proceeds are laundered, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is that
there was no charge here, I take it, that what was being laundered was somebody's eight-hour day.
Well, the charge did allow that what was being laundered was Mr. Alenta's honest services. If you look at the intent to defraud instruction, the scheme to defraud instruction, even the...
That's why I asked, was there any problem with the money laundering charge? That is, it said that the thing being laundered was proceeds. Did it not?
Yes, it did.
Right.
And then the instructions...
There was no allegation that the thing being laundered was time on the job or honest services.
Well, the instruction...
The allegation was the thing being laundered was proceeds.
The thing being laundered was proceeds, but if you look at the instructions, and the word proceeds must come up, it comes up many times. And when it talks about proceeds and when it talks about the thing to defraud, it collapses money, property, and honest services. The definition of proceeds was not limited to money or property, and honest services was part of the case.
Did you ask for such limiting instruction?
No. The objection was made to allowing honest services to serve as a predicate for the money laundering. That objection was made during the trial and in the context of jury instructions. And in fact, Judge Grady originally was not going to give an honest services mail fraud type instructions because he initially agreed with the defendant's position. The deprivation of honest services being an object of the fraud was part of the case, and it was not excluded from the definition of proceeds. The error here is in allowing honest services mail fraud to serve as a predicate for a money laundering offense, which is a financial offense. This position is also based by an examination of the statutes. The money laundering statute lists the predicate crimes, and 18 U.S.C. 1346 is not listed.
But 1346 is not a crime. It's a definitional clause.
It's a definition.
The crime is 1341.
Right.
It is listed.
And if you looked at 1341 alone, that does not state the offense of operating to deprive another of honest services.
I'm completely lost. That's like saying, in order to define an offense, somebody looked in Black's Law Dictionary. The money laundering statute does not refer to Black's Law Dictionary. Therefore, this can't be a predicate offense. It's not an argument. It doesn't even have the form of an argument.
Take 1341 before McNally. If you just looked at 1341 without 1346, there would be no crime to defraud another of honest services, and that's our position. Our next objection goes to what was referred to as Court's Instruction 40 in the court below. Again, the parties agree that a de novo standard of review applies. In approximately 11 places, the indictment charged that the funds extracted by Alenta from ABI were portions of the premiums charged by ABI to Rosemont. In some instances, the indictment alleged that they were actually portions of the premiums charged. At trial, the government did not introduce any evidence to contradict this. They didn't call any banking-type witness to state that the funds in ABI's account did not belong to Rosemont, as alleged in the indictment. And you have to remember, we're dealing with a premium trust account. This is not an ordinary bank account. It's not like a checking account or a savings account. This is an account where the broker holds the funds in trust for the insured. And the disposition of those funds have to be made according to the statute. So it's not a regular bank account, as the district court seemed to place it in that category.
When you say in trust for the insured, is this in the event of a claim?
Well, the premium trust account is a account where an insurance broker receives the premiums, which in turn a brokerage doesn't underwrite the insurance. It has to contact another company to underwrite it. So they hold all the premiums, and they're supposed to use the funds from that account to pay the actual insurance company. Now, they can use funds for operating expenses and their own profits, but it has to go according to statute.
Well, does every when someone pays their premium, does that whole premium go into the trust fund?
It goes into the premium trust fund at first. Yes.
Is this the premium trust fund we're talking about?
Yes, it is.
So that's when someone, if I pay my insurance, that's where it goes. Now, obviously, a lot of that goes to the, we'll call it the underwriting or whatever it is, the insurance company, the one that's actually insuring. Does a portion of this go to pay the staff at the broker?
Yes, it does, but there has to be reconciliation according to the statute. There has to be disclosure of the fees to the insured. It's a highly regulated statute under state law.
So all this trust fund is under close scrutiny, I guess.
Supposedly.
Okay, and so what was going on here that you think was improperly instructed?
That the problem is the instruction which, A, contradicted the indictment. The indictment said that the funds which were withdrawn were portions of the premiums which belonged to Rosemont. Now, Rosemont was not charged as a victim in the indictment, and that's important because the focus of the government's case was whether the defendants intended to deprive ABI of Alenta's honest services and money and property.
Now, would Rosemont get any money if it was, let's say, a return of premium or a dividend or an overcharge of some kind? I'm not sure how that works, but sometimes that you get money back if you paid too much for the insurance.
Right. Rosemont would be entitled to that money.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I want to hear going on.
ABI was not entitled to any fees which were not disclosed to Rosemont. In this case, there were two sorts of fees. One was the money that was used to pay Alenta and Mr. Boscarino, and two was ABI Accordia itself received about half of the overcharges over the period that this occurred.
Was that legitimate?
No, it was not legitimate. They were not entitled to that. The defense wanted an instruction that stated under Illinois law that, that ABI would not be entitled to this. The district court denied that. And this also is important to our restitution argument that I'll get to in a minute. The instruction, court's instruction 40, was also problematic because, as I stated, there was no evidence to support it. The government didn't call a witness to state that, hey, these funds belong to ABI and Rosemont had no interest in them. They just didn't produce any evidence, so the instruction operated to fill a void in the evidence, and it directed a finding of facts on the issue of whose funds they were. Now, maybe they were ABI Accordia's funds, but this was an issue which the jury should have determined based on all the evidence, not a slanted instruction that said you should determine. I am telling you that these are ABI's funds. That should have been an issue for the jury to determine, not the court. The instruction also referred to the fraudulent scheme in the indictment, but when the judge instructed on the indictment, he made a number of statements which were actually declarative statements that said the defendants conducted sham transactions, the mailings did occur, and he didn't state it in terms of it is alleged or this is what the government claims. Now, to lawyers, I think we all know what the district court was trying to do, but you have to put yourself in the shoes of a juror. They've never been in a courtroom before, in all likelihood, and they don't know that this is what the judge is trying to do. They're hearing the judge make a declarative statement to them. The defendants committed these sham transactions. The mailings did occur. So
well,
when this
what was it? What is this? In some of them, it said that the government, whatever it is, alleges.
That's
now
correct.
You're saying this was not in some of the instruction, or it was, it just confused the jury?
What the district court did, it did not give the jury a copy of the indictment. The district court summarized the indictment on its own, and in the course of doing that, the court said, it is alleged,
okay.
And then would drop off from that and make this declarative statement. Now, a jury sitting in the box, they're hearing the oral instructions. It's kind of hard to grasp, but there's a distinction there that this is only an allegation. It's coming from the court. It sounds like a pronouncement that the defendants did it. So there's a problem even when court's instruction 40 refers to the scheme charged in the indictment.
You have the same problem if you hand the indictment to the jury. Looks as just official then, too.
Well, it does look official, but they at least get an instruction that tells them that this indictment is being given to you, and there are only allegations in here. It's not to be construed as evidence against the defendants. In this case, it's the district court's preference not to give the jury a copy of the indictment, and that's what happened. Mr. Boscarino also challenges the sufficiency of the evidence on the money laundering. Ralph Alento was the person who owed the fiduciary duty to ABI. Mr. Boscarino did not owe a fiduciary duty to ABI. He was never employed by ABI. He was a customer of ABI. The government did not introduce any evidence that Mr. Boscarino had specialized knowledge of insurance regulations. And the question on review is whether the government presented sufficient evidence that Mr. Boscarino knew that the proceeds involved in the monetary transactions were criminally deprived property. In ruling on our bond motion, Judge Grady found that of the issues presented in the bond motion, this was probably the closest one and the one that he had the most respect for. The underlying illegality here, the underlying crimes, stem from two sources. One is the withdrawal of funds from ABI's premium trust account, and two would be the failure to disclose fees to Rosemont. Now, Rosemont was not named as a victim in the indictment, and Alenta did not inform Boscarino that Rosemont was being cheated or that its bill was being padded. In fact, he testified that Mr. Boscarino, who had close ties with the officials in Rosemont, wouldn't stand for Rosemont being cheated. So Rosemont's the overbilling of Rosemont is not the basis for the charge. It was the taking of the money from ABI Accordia. Mr. Alenta, the government's main witness, testified that referral fees are sometimes paid. They're sometimes paid to non-brokers, and that this was legal in his view. He testified that he did not inform Mr. Boscarino that he was violating the law. He testified that he did not inform Mr. Boscarino that he was violating company policy. The government made much of the fact that the fees were not disclosed as such in some of ABI's internal accounting records, but those records weren't disclosed to Mr. Boscarino. He would have no way of knowing how a clerk at ABI recorded this fee. But on top of that, the fees were actually disclosed in the ABI Accordia files. The government argues that there was concealment from ABI, but in fact that did not occur.
Would it be normal to have a referral fee year after year instead of the first referral?
I can't bring any independent knowledge as to whether that would be normal. I just don't know. I can't say, but the insurance was contracted on a year-to-year basis. So that was the basis for the year-to-year fee.
Would this be called he was sharing in the commission?
Well, it was not a legitimate commission because a legitimate commission would have to be disclosed to the insured, and here there was no dispute that it was not.
In reality, isn't that what was going on?
Yeah, he was sharing the commission. Now, Mr. Alenta was the president of ABI. It was not a large firm. It had about 30 employees, two salespersons, and it was it appeared as if to Mr. Boscarino, Mr. Alenta was in charge of ABI, and in fact he was, at least here locally. And if the ABI files indicated that there would be referral payments to Mr. Boscarino, so that was known. The clerks knew that the payments were being made, so there was no concealment from ABI. The government relies on the fact that there were multiple transactions. Multiple transactions in and of themselves are not illegal, and the actual disposition in the charge monetary transactions here were the withdrawal of monies from a Schwab account that was both in Boscarino's name and Alenta's name, and the disposition of those funds went to accounts which were readily associated with the defendants. There was no use of nominees. There were no offshore companies or no shell companies, not the type of things that you typically see in a money laundering case. One issue that I think is important here that dovetails with the arguments we've made this morning is the restitution. The government argues that the restitution should be reviewed on a plain error standard, but Mr. Boscarino objected time and time again on the basis that ABI was not entitled to the undisclosed fees. And in fact, at the sentencing at page 18 of our appendix of the main brief and page 28, Mr. Tewitt, the defense lawyer, again argued, I bring out that ABI didn't lose any money and we're not waiving this. And the district court said, I understand, you're not waiving it. Now, it is true that when the district court said, granted Mr. Anderson's motion for restitution, Mr. Boscarino's lawyer didn't say, I object. But the substance of his position was put before the district court. The district court had an opportunity to rule upon it. It was clear that he was ruling against Mr. Boscarino. So this is not a case where we're trying to sandbag and the issue is being brought up for the first time in the appellate court. It was raised in a variety of contexts in the appellate court. ABI Accordia was not entitled to these overcharges, not entitled to the money that was used to pay Alenta and Boscarino, not entitled to the money it kept for itself without disclosing it to Rosemont. Yet restitution was ordered. The purpose of restitution is to compensate the victim for actual pecuniary losses. ABI didn't have clean hands here. The people at ABI knew what was going on. They created dummy invoices, and they weren't entitled to the money. So this is not compensating them for a loss. There has to be a distinction between forfeiture and restitution. Now, if these were ill-gotten gains, then they should be forfeited, and in fact they were. In fact, Mr. Boscarino did not contest a forfeiture after the jury verdict. But if they were not, if the ill-gotten gains is taking care of the forfeiture, but the restitution is loss-based, and here there was no actual loss to ABI Accordia. That also impacts the sentence if the purpose of the loss increase is to determine how much worse off the victim was made by the crime, as this court said in Spano, in looking to the guidelines that have the foundation foundation of pecuniary harm is the basis for loss. There was no pecuniary harm to ABI Accordia. The loss here was a non-economic loss, and it was a gain which should not have been ordered to be repaid by the restitution statutes. I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Thank Morgan. You. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the court. First, our argument that was raised by the defendant this morning was the question with regard to the honest services mail fraud. And I think classically what has happened here, as pointed out by this court, is the defendant has confused the means of committing the crime with the object of the crime. 1346 is a mere definitional statute. One cannot be charged with 1346. But section 1346 defines one of the means by which the crime may be committed. And so fraud may be committed by the deprivation of honest services. That is one of the means by which the crime may be committed. Once the crime is committed, it has an object. In this case, the object was money. Under section under 1961 and 1957, criminally derived property is defined as property constituting or derived from proceeds of a criminal offense. So the question is, do we have a criminal offense here? And we do. We have the violation of mail fraud by the deprivation of honest services. Did it result in proceeds? Yes, it did. It was the property, the object of the crime. And that was then money laundered. So I would submit that the argument must fail because the defendant has simply overlooked the fact that 1346 is definitional. It defines one of the means by which the crime may be committed. It was committed in that way. In this case, it produced proceeds that were money laundered. The defendant next argues with regard to jury instruction number 40. And he argues that it instructed the jury as to certain facts, but that is not the case. If you look at this jury instruction, it's a classic if-then instruction. Here the jury was being told that only if they found certain facts could they then reach a certain legal determination. They were told that only if they found that money was in this premium trust account, and as has been pointed out this morning, the premium trust account was an account into which all insurance payments went. They sat in this account, and then out of that account, the insurance company would pay the ultimate company from whom they purchased the insurance. Money that was left over was profit. It was profit for Mr. Alenta and for ABI. It would go to pay salaries. It would go to pay for other expenses. But the jury was told only if they found the money was taken out of the account, only if it found it was taken out pursuant to the scheme charge, a scheme to defraud ABI, only if they found it was taken out by Alenta and Boscarino for their own purposes, and only if they found it was taken out without the knowledge of ABI, then and only then could they find that ABI had been defrauded out of that money. It was telling the jury as a matter of law, not as a matter of fact, and it certainly did not contradict the indictment in any way whatsoever. It was telling the jury that the money in that account was in the possession of ABI. It was addressing the issue of who held that money, and it was telling the jury if they made certain facts, they could find that ABI Accordia was defrauded out of that money.
Now, was all that money eligible to be taken out for some legitimate purpose?
It was all the money into that account came from companies such that purchased insurance.
Yeah, but I mean the whatever amount. Let's say there's $1,000 in the trust account. All of that money would be taken out of there for one point or another
would all come out.
Yeah.
It would either come off to pay the ultimate party from whom the insurance was purchased, or it would come out as profits.
So it's whatever is coming out, it came out for the wrong reasons, I guess.
Exactly. What
and
happened?
What reasons were those?
Well, the reason in this case, it was taken out to pay off for Alenta and Boscarino to defraud ABI Accordia of this money. It was money to which they were not entitled. But they decided to set up this scheme by taking the money out into false entities so that they and then put it into various checking accounts and other means so that they could have the money for themselves.
Who should have gotten it instead?
Well, what happened in this case was, in the end, Rosemont was overbilled. And as the record below establishes, in the end, Rosemont ended up suing ABI Accordia for $1 million. And in the end, ABI agreed to pay Rosemont $500,000. So the money that was in that account, there was an excess amount of money in that account because Rosemont had been overcharged. So instead of being there to pay back Rosemont, the party to whom ABI ultimately agreed to pay it to, it wasn't there. And so ABI Accordia was defrauded out of that money that could have gone to pay off Rosemont, that could have gone to pay off the $500,000 settlement. So in this case, the jury was simply told by the judge that, indeed, you can't steal from a thief. Even if ABI Accordia was a thief, the money was in their possession. They were defrauded out of that money, and the money was no longer there in ABI Accordia's possession to pay off Rosemont or any other party who might have a claim to that money. And so this was a classic if-then instruction. The jury was not given any facts. They were told they could make certain findings of law if they found certain facts. It didn't contradict the indictment in any way whatsoever. It was a mere statement of law given by the judge to the jury to help them explain the status of the money that was in that account. The defendant argues in this court that the court stated certain facts to the jury and didn't use terms like charge and allege, etc. In making this argument, the defendant has completely ripped out of context statements made by the court in both the oral instructions and in its written instructions. For instance, if you look at the written instructions that were given to the jury, the paragraph starts out, "The indictment alleges," and then maybe have two or three sentences in that paragraph. What the defendant has done is ripped the second sentence out of the paragraph that began, "This is what the indictment alleges." Again, jury instructions have to be read in context. When read in context and listened to in context, there could have been no question in the jury's mind that these were mere allegations, mere charges that were being set forth for them in summarizing the indictment. The defendant also argues that with regard to the charge with regard to the fraud, he charges that the defendant was not shown to know that the money would be laundered was the product of fraud, the product of a crime. But in this case, the multi-stage complexity of what happened over this entire six-year period was sufficient for the jury to find that the defendant knew that this was money to which he had no right. Over each of these 6 years, the transactions were cloaked and disguised in such a way as to hide from ABI the fact that this money was going to Boscarino and Alenta. Boscarino was an experienced businessman. He headed up several companies. He knew how a legitimate president of a company such as Alenta ought to be paid, and that's not what was going on here. He knew how a legitimate vendor ought to be paid, and this is not the way he got the money. Each year was different. Each year was a cloaking and disguising of the payments. For instance, in 1992, Boscarino talks Alenta in making that year's payoff payable to one of Boscarino's companies, OG Services. They get the check to OG Services. Boscarino endorses it. Then he and Alenta go to a bank where they exchange that check for a cashier's check made out to Alenta with the bank as the remitter. Alenta then puts that check into his own private checking account, out of which over the next couple months he makes cash and check payments to Boscarino. This was sufficient evidence for the jury to find that the defendant knew that something was up, that it was the product of fraud, it was the product of a criminal offense.
Would this then, with the advent of this, be when, as I understand it, when Boscarino introduced Alenta to Accordia?
What happened was is that Boscarino had connections with the town of Rosemont.
I'm sorry.
And with high public officials in the town of Rosemont.
Okay.
And what Boscarino did was introduce Alenta to town officials and ended up having a meeting with the deputy mayor Stevens of Rosemont in setting this up.
So he got the account.
He helped him get the account.
And then, and as it turns out, this account, which wasn't, well, I guess I'm not sure about putting up for bids or whatever. They got the other bid and underbid it, but they got a sweetheart deal that later found out to be was much too high.
Well, exactly.
But that's how all this started.
Exactly.
And that's where this extra money
exactly.
came into play.
What happened was is then that what Alenta, the first year, Alenta disclosed the additional fees that it was charging Rosemont. It was disclosed to Rosemont that an extra $37,000 was pumped into the contract, out of which they pulled out about $32,000 or so. The remaining years, Atlanta didn't disclose to Rosemont the additional charges, as they ought to have under Illinois insurance law. So by pumping up what Rosemont was paying and getting it to AB Accordia, they were then able to siphon it out of AB Accordia through payments to Boscarino's companies, various companies over this six-year period of time.
But Rosemont didn't put it up for bid in those years.
No, they did not.
And that's what that seemed to be a reassurance that this
exactly.
Was
Each year it wasn't put up for rebid. Finally, the last year, 1997, it was put up for rebid, and ABI didn't get it its final year, so the scheme was over. But over that period of time, they'd be able to steal about a little over $288,000 from ABI Accordia by overcharging Rosemont. And really, that brings us to the argument of the defendant that ABI Accordia was not entitled to restitution. Indeed, ABI Accordia was entitled to restitution because they were a victim. There was money that was put into that premium trust account that was pulled out. The $288,000 that belonged to ABI Accordia was pulled out. If, as it turned out, someone else had a right to that money, a superior right to that money, in this case it was Rosemont, to the tune of $500,000, that $288,000 was no longer there to satisfy the judgment against from Rosemont. So indeed, ABI Accordia needed to be made whole. They had been charged over $500,000, $288,000 had been taken out, so they could have been used to satisfy the $500,000, therefore it was appropriate. And again, the defendant did not raise an objection to the restitution below. He's pointed this court to page 18 of his supplemental appendix. That is an objection he was raising to the increase of the guidelines because of amount loss. It wasn't an objection that he posited based on the idea of restitution. And with going to the offense level, it was appropriate for the offense level to be raised by the $288,000 because that was the actual loss to ABI Accordia. $288,000 that was in the account was pulled out. And again, as I pointed out, that was money that was no longer available to ABI Accordia to pay Rosemont for what was rightfully Rosemont's. For these reasons,
I would like one other thing that wasn't brought up, and that's on this Boscarino-Borsellino joint account.
Very good.
I don't exactly understand how this was and why this was set up, but it appears that while by their practice it was a 50-50, but Boscarino took 100% of the
losses.
Is that
right?
What the
crime That's basically
crime
what
was?
Happened. What we have here was a situation where below the evidence had to do with a Boscarino Borsellino trading stock and options trading account. The evidence below in the letter of September 30, 1999 was that this was a joint account. They were joint partners, and so they should have both been responsible for doing half of the profits and losses. What happened in this case is that Boscarino claimed all of the losses instead of just his 50% of the losses. And under the terms of the September 30, 1999 letter, which was a letter from Mr. Mangerton, who was Mr. Boscarino's accountant, also a co-conspirator, to Mr. Borsellino, he set out, and that's set forth in the United States Appendix, that by the terms of that letter, it was a joint trading partnership in which they were both 50-50 responsible. There is no evidence whatsoever in the record to establish the fact that Boscarino put up that money. The only evidence whatsoever there was an allegation that Boscarino put up the money came from Mr. Mangerton. Mr. Mangerton claimed that he had seen records, or it was his understanding that somehow Boscarino had put up the money, therefore he was entitled to the full deductions. But no records were put into evidence, and certainly the $500,000 loan that the defendant talks about in his brief, there was no evidence whatsoever below to establish that $500,000 loan was any money put up by Boscarino. Instead, it appears it was a joint trading account. They were both responsible for the gains and the losses, but instead of splitting them 50-50, Boscarino claimed the entirety of that amount. And so the jury made the finding it did based on the 930 letter, based on the testimony of Revenue Agent Lexby, and the testimony of Weisberg, who was an accountant for Mr. Borsellino.
And that ended up in the false statements in the tax returns then.
Exactly. For those reasons, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Anything further, Mr. Martin? You have about 30 seconds.
30 seconds. With respect to the tax counts, the government claims there is no evidence that a loan was made. Attached to their brief are two promissory notes signed by Mr. Borsellino. Why would Mangerton send a letter to Borsellino's accountant unless the account was in Mr. Boscarino's name? It's a basic principle of tax law that you cannot transfer your loss to someone else. If there's a partnership, you have to look to the economic reality, and there are provisions in the tax code, which we cite in our brief, that state that you can't deduct losses when they're sustained from borrowed funds and amounts was borrowed from a person who had an interest in the activity. Here, Mr. Boscarino had an interest in the activity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.